Thank you very much indeed for coming to my second lecture, which concerns the puzzle of the origin of the modern world. In a way, this puzzle is like a jigsaw puzzle, where you have lots of bits and you don't know how they fit together. Or, to put it another way, to make the modern world, you had to have a key, like a door key. Old-fashioned keys would be something like this. And the key to unlock modernity is something like this, but much more complicated. You might have 10 different features like religion, politics, economics. And in order to unlock our modern world, you had to have the right combination of characteristics for this key. Just the right amount of religion, the right amount of politics, the right science, the right social structure. And to get all those things together at the right time, in the right place, was a miracle, was extraordinary. There was no necessity for it to happen. And what I'm trying to do in these lectures is to explain to you my theory of how this happened in one island in England, and then has been spread through America and the British Empire all over the world. So in the first lecture, I talked about the question, which is why and when and how did the modern world emerge. When I talked about the modern world, I gave you a definition of what I mean by modernity, which is what I call the separation of spheres or separation of institutions. Human beings usually have four main aspects to their lives: politics, society or family, economics, and religion or ideology. And in most societies, in tribal societies and elsewhere, these are all bound together. You can't separate out. The family is also the place where you worship and where you work together and so on. Gradually, civilizations emerge by the splitting of these apart. So the early civilizations split off society and economy from politics and religion. And my definition of the modern world is one where you have, in theory at least, a strong separation. So politics is separate from religion. Politics is separate from society. The economy is free because it is not embedded, as some anthropologists describe it, in the society. And that is something which is very unusual, very difficult to maintain. It's an ideal, of course, in practice, people are constantly joining them together. And this is what we call corruption, where you let economics get mixed up with politics or religion with politics. But we try in the West, in England, America, and elsewhere, to keep these as separate. And you may like to think, as Chinese scholars, as to what extent this model of separations works for China itself. So I posed the question, and in the second part of the first lecture, I looked at what made Britain a place which, if it was modern, would project modernity all over the world. And the reasons were that it was a very powerful at war. It fought on other people's lands, but it was very peaceful at home because it was an island. So it had the advantages of war, but not the disadvantages. It was a great trading nation. It expanded its trade networks all over the world, including China, India, and obviously the Americas. And it ended up, as a result of those two things, with a new kind of empire, which was based on trade, and became the largest empire the world has ever known, or will probably ever know. A quarter of the world's population, a quarter of the world's land surface in the 19th century was British. And so, and of course America earlier on, so this very powerful small island came to dominate the whole of the world for 100 and 150 years. In this lecture, I want to turn to the reasons why it was able to be so rich and powerful in its trade and its war and its empire, and to look firstly at another feature of England which it has exported over the whole world, which is the industrial system, factory industry based on non-human labour. Now, if you look at all the development of industrialism, if you use the metaphor or the idea taken from Rostow, The Conditions of Economic Progress, his famous book, of an aeroplane taking off into modernity and the Industrial Revolution, then on the runway for the last 300 years, the first takeoff around 1760, 1780 was England and southern Scotland. Then for another 50 years, roughly, there were no more. Then in the 1830s, parts of Western Europe, the Netherlands, Germany, and France, Northern Europe, took off into industrial civilization. Then, towards the end of the 19th century, there were two more takeoffs, namely Japan and the United States. Then, around 1920, there was another takeoff, namely the Soviet Union, which had just been formed, or Russia. Now, the reason this is important is that when you looked at history from this point, say when de Tocqueville was writing, the only place which had had an industrial revolution was England. And therefore the question was, how did this miracle happen in England? That was the question of modernity. Why did this island suddenly move from an agrarian civilization into something new? It was the only place. Then when you had these European countries joining it, the question turned to why the West European miracle? Then when you had the US and Japan joining, the question became why the West, including America and Japan, are able to do this? This is the question. In fact, Max Weber wasn't really interested in Japan, so Max Weber's question was, why the West? That was his great puzzle behind a lot of his work. By the time of the Second World War, 1945, that was the state of industrial takeoffs. 1950s, 60s, you have the Four Little Tigers. South Korea, Hong Kong, and so on. These could be explained within this model by saying these are all either offshoots of Japan, like Taiwan or South Korea, or of Britain, like Hong Kong. But then, and so the question could stay the same, then around the 1970s, 80s, three quarters of the rest of the world, i.e. India and China and Brazil, South America, took off. So at the end of the 20th century, this happened. Now, the effect of this has been, I won't go into it, is that people have said, oh, well, Max Weber thought it was all very difficult. There was something special about the West. And Karl Marx thought the East was caught in an Asiatic mode of production and would never become modern. Now we can see it wasn't so difficult after all. Look, everyone's doing it, except just a few countries in Africa and elsewhere. But basically, the question shifts, and this is a very interesting thing. Historical questions shift with the context, the political context within which they're asked. So now people, global historians, world historians, are saying, well, all that stuff about Western exceptionalism is nonsense. Anyone can do it. The great divergence between the East and the West didn't occur right back here, and isn't early, and isn't related to deep structural factors contrasting civilizations. It's just a superficial difference, starting perhaps around here, whereby the West, this area, went in a certain direction, and China and India went in a different direction. The argument of Pomerantz and other people of the Californian school is that there was no real structural difference, and no wealth difference, no expectation of life difference between the West and the East until about here and then. So what I think has happened is that these recent thinkers are asking questions from the late 20th century and seeing it all as quite inevitable. And the question really then is that anyone can have an industrial revolution, but why didn't China not have one? And then the answer is it lacked two things. It lacked coal, which of course it doesn't lack, but it didn't use coal, or an empire to have raw materials coming in. So China diverged because it lacked a couple of fairly superficial things, coal and an empire. Anyway, the thing I want to look at now is this Industrial Revolution, because the escape from a world of agricultural poverty is very important to all of us. It changed the whole world, and it is, to my mind, certain that we would have not had a modern industrial world without in England. Part of this revisionist thinking is that, well, it's inevitable anyway. If England hadn't had an industrial revolution then, Japan would have had one then, or France would have had one then, or, you know, it's an obvious thing to do, to use coal and fossil fuels. In fact, there is no evidence that any other nation on this planet was heading towards industrialism. And therefore, I am certain that without the English case, we would still be a world of perhaps 500 million, 750 million, which is all that you can have on this planet from using plants and animals. And we would, 3/4 of us would be living on the soil, working incredibly hard, dying young and impoverished. So perhaps the greatest contribution of the English in one way, if you think it's a great thing, is to have created the first industrial revolution, which has spread. Because when he looked around him, around here, 1786, the publication of The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith said there is going to be no further progress. Europe has reached a threshold. He saw that Mediterranean Europe, that is Italy, Spain, Portugal, was getting poorer. It had been getting poorer for 200 years. France was getting nowhere, static. He spent time in France. Holland, the great rich country of Holland, had reached an equilibrium, what Chinese scholars of China, or my friend Mark Elwin, has called the high-level equilibrium trap. It wasn't growing. There were only two countries which were still economically growing in Adam Smith's day, and they were England and North America. There were innate limits, in other words, to growth, which he, as the first great economist, modern classical economist, and Malthus was the second, recognized, which is that if you use sunlight coming through photosynthesis in plants and animals, you can only use a tiny part of its energy, only enough really to feed with the technologies of the time and any future technologies you could imagine, only enough to feed something like 500 million people. We now have 12 times that on the planet. Not only was that a limit to growth, which he could, Adam Smith could see no escape from, but when countries did become rich, as he saw around him, they destroy this wealth through war. They fight each other, great wars plunge them back into a lower standard of living, or they become inevitably more unequal. You get growing social hierarchies, growing absolutism, or another more dangerous track, which Holland had, which is that you begin to live off trade, interest, banks, dealing in money, and you don't make things. So Holland was trapped by a mercantile wealth. So as he looked around him, Smith, he saw a Malthusian world, a world described by Malthus, which is held back by war, famine, and disease. He saw this happening in China as well. He wrote about China, as had Montesquieu, and they both saw the same thing from the reports of China. What they saw was what has been described rather well and interestingly by, first of all, by a Japanese economic historian, friend of mine called Hayami. And Hayami distinguished between what he called an industrial revolution, which is where you use more and more non-human labor, industrial, and an industrious. Industrious means hard-working. What had happened, what Hayami points out, is that Japan had had an industrious revolution. They had worked harder and harder at rice cultivation and other things. So they had become a little richer through hard work, but not through the use of non-human energy. And indeed, all of Europe and Japan and China were moving along an industrious path. 18th century China, from the descriptions I've had of it, even the richest areas in the Yangtze Delta, which Li Bizhong and others have analyzed so well, were founded on incredibly hard work. The same in Japan, very, very, very hard work. Working all through the day, weekends, using human muscle power. The accounts of 18th century China just show that simple tasks like pressing oil, most of agriculture, weaving and so on, was largely done by human muscle power, not by something else. What differentiates the West and what makes the long-term industrial revolution in the West is the path, the movement down a new path for human beings, a path of industry, moving away from human energy to non-human energy. And it starts a long time ago. The British Industrial Revolution is often thought of as an 18th century phenomenon, but it actually starts 700 years earlier. It's 1,000 years of accumulative growth. For example, in 1086, that is nearly 1,000 years ago, there was a huge survey of England called the Domesday Book, which surveyed all the villages of England and noted down what was in each village. And it noted down that there were 5,500 water mills at that time in 3,000 communities, which worked out as roughly one water mill, that is a mill for grinding corn and other things driven by water, for every 50 households. So this meant that instead of having to do that back-breaking work, you could use a machine. Most societies have such a large population, and this was one of the problems that China had and India, that it's cheaper to force people to be slaves or to work long hours grinding than to use a machine. Machinery is too expensive. There are no advantages. And the Romans had slaves, so they didn't develop water mills. England went towards water power very early. And they also went towards wind power, windmills. It's said that the first effective modern kind of windmill was invented in England, in Yorkshire, in the 13th century. And more work was done by wind and water, but above all it was done by animals. The English, having a rich countryside with good grass and a light population, used most of it to keep animals. And animals do the work for human beings. They provide meat, milk, cheese, butter, leather for clothing, and obviously they can also plow, carry, drive mills. And so they are, and provide wool and so on, and they can therefore take a huge burden off human beings. So the English went down the path of using animals, so that by the time of that doomsday book that I mentioned, by the late 11th century, it's estimated that 70% of all non-human energy consumed in England came from animals. A lot of the rest of it came from sheep, huge flocks of sheep. The largest cathedrals in Europe are in England, and they were built 12th, 13th, 14th century. There's only one cathedral outside England which is as big as the big English cathedrals, and that's in Rome, St. Paul's. And these cathedrals were built on the, I shouldn't have called it St. Paul's, St. Peter's, I suppose it is. But anyway, these huge English cathedrals were built from the wealth from wool, which was exported to France. So you had an agriculture which was developing cows, which gave proteins in the form of milk and cheese and butter and meat and manure and so on and so on. And finally you had wonderful horses. The English horses were soon bred to be very strong. They're much more powerful than oxen or any other kind of plough animal. And they became the strongest, best machines. There were millions of them. By the 18th century, there were millions of horses in England. So the English developed a labour-saving approach through the use of non-human energy. And then in the famous 18th century, supposed agricultural revolution, you get new fertilisers, you get winter food being provided for the animals, so you didn't have to kill them. When we were at school, we learnt about someone called Turnip Townsend. Turnips are large sort of things you grow in the ground and you give to animals in the winter. Well, Turnip Townsend was a nobleman, Lord Townsend, who went to King's College, Cambridge, where I am. And he developed on his Norfolk farms this method of keeping animals alive through the winter. So you get better and better water mills and windmills, and better crop rotation so you can grow more. And the animals are improved. So that you get a phenomenon you get in no other country, which is that the agriculture is so efficient by the 18th century that people working in the countryside, without working particularly hard by Asian standards, much less hard, can produce so much food that they can feed themselves well, live well, but also support something like 40% of the population in cities or not doing agricultural tasks. The problem in most societies is that everyone, you can only produce enough food just to feed yourself and your family, and then maybe a little bit in taxes to your landlord, but you can't build up big cities or crafts or non-agricultural occupations because agriculture won't produce those surpluses. And the last aspect of this is obviously the development of machines using non-human power. What happened? Pomerance and others seem to think that the discovery of coal occurred around here, and then England and the rest took off. But in fact, coal had been used in England for hundreds, if not a thousand years. It was being used really from the time of the Norman invasion or before. And if you start using coal, it has all sorts of effects. One of them is, of course, to release a lot of land. Most peasant societies have to use a lot of their land for growing wood, for heating, for cooking, for all sorts of purposes. Perhaps a third of your land in a place like India has to be devoted to some way of producing fuel energy. Coal in England began to be used from the Anglo-Saxon period onwards, and by the 1560s, by the time of Queen Elizabeth, if this is total energy production leads, by the time of Queen Elizabeth, something like 10% of the energy in England by the time of Queen Elizabeth was coming from coal. It may not seem very much to you, but if you have an agricultural economy, if you can get energy, 10% of your energy from some other form of energy like that, it's a great, enormous help. By 1700, by the time of Daniel Defoe and the beginning of the 18th century, 100 years before Pomerance's great divergence, 50% of English energy was coming from coal. By 1760, just 10 years later, 60%. So great was the production in this little island that by 1700, England's coal output was five times more than the whole of the rest of the world, China, Japan, Europe, America. And by 1800, it was still so far ahead that it was five times the rest of Europe. Now, what is most important is not only that coal allowed it didn't cause the Industrial Revolution, there were other factors, it allowed it, but it also allowed it to continue. Because the puzzle about the Industrial Revolution is not just about why it started, but why it didn't stop. It would have been not impossible to think that you could have a sudden burst of efficiency and energy and better agriculture, which would last for one generation. But how do you have growth recurring, as one author has put it, constant growth that we have become used to as a feature of modernity? And as Tony Ridley, who is the great expert on this, says, the puzzle really is why the Industrial Revolution continued, and the reason it was able to continue is the increasing use of coal. And why it continued later on, of course, is the increasing use of oil. We would not have an industrial world without those two fuels. So, basically, with a number of great inventions, the double condenser of James Watt and all the other mechanical inventions of the 18th century, what you were able to do was something magical. Up till now, human beings, that is for the last 50,000 years of Homo sapiens, human beings had just been able to live off what you might call a current account in their bank. They could just live off the sunlight coming down onto the trees and then cutting down the trees and coming down onto their plants and eating the plants and so on. And this only, they skimmed across the surface of current energy from the sun. Suddenly, magically, they could go down into a treasure world where the sunlight of millions of years, which had fallen on the surface, had been sunk and buried as hidden carbon energy, and they could draw this up. So we are living off the deposited account of millions of years of sunlight. Having this great advantage of agriculture and industry, you could then produce goods, sell them to your empire, produce metal manufacturers, make warships, guns, and so on. And so it fed back into trade, war, and empire, and projected. England was 50 years ahead, so it's not so surprising that it could conquer one quarter of the world. And it could end up by assaulting China, getting the treaty ports, and spreading English goods, customs, culture all over the world, because it was technologically two generations ahead of anywhere else. So that our world is basically an industrial one, originally made in England, even if still in the world, over half the world's population live on the land. The world has been changed, it is turned on its axis as a result of chance events on one small island.